Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today, notably here in Oklahoma, in Florida, and a handful of other states, there are high-profile efforts to reframe and shape what is taught in public schools. From the elimination of multiple viewpoints of our history, banning access to books in school libraries for a variety of reasons, teaching about our fraught racial history, to the elimination of diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts at the college level. There's also a harsh rhetoric that vilifies these issues, and there are efforts to ban subject matter, some of which isn't even actually taught in K-12 classrooms. During the spring of 1975, Wayne Woodward, an idealistic young middle school English teacher in Hereford, Texas, a town in the Texas Panhandle, was called into the principal's office and fired. His misdeed? He founded a local chapter of the ACLU. While this gross violation of his civil rights was addressed in court, he found he couldn't find another teaching job in Texas and left the profession. This individual story from the 1970s points to a larger story that is readily apparent both in hindsight and equally active today, a contemporary radical conservatism, which is growing and taking root as far back as the 1970s in places like Hereford, Texas, which helped this movement grow. Last fall, I spoke with Timothy Paul Bowman, a professor of history at West Texas A&M University. His book, You Will Never Be One of Us, deftly weaves Woodward's story, along with the story of panhandle conservatism and the growth of a rural-urban political divide that defines our politics today. I spoke with him back in October of 2022. Timothy Bowman, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks very much for having me, Rich.
You know, in your book, You Will Never Be One of Us, you relate a 1970s era case of a Texas Panhandle school teacher who was fired for, in essence, founding a local chapter of the ACLU in Hereford, Texas. Why is this story of the teacher, Wayne Woodward, important to us today?
You know, partly for me, when I started working on the book, you know, I'm 43 years old now, so I was in my late 30s when I started writing the book, and I found Wayne, who's still living, he lives in a little community between the cities of Canyon and Amarillo in the Texas Panhandle today. I found him relatable. You know, here was a young, idealistic teacher, and of course, teachers are, you know, I think by nature idealistic, who thought he was doing something that was good for the community and would be celebrated in announcing this founding of the chapter of the ACLU. And boy, was he wrong, you know, in running afoul of the town's power brokers and, most consequentially, his boss, a principal at La Plata Junior High School, a gentleman by the name of Robert Hughes. He did something that was, I think, essentially forbidden in the eyes of the public. You know, I think that it's relatable in that we're a very fractured nation today. One of the things that attracted me to writing Wayne's story was that this was a case of the culture wars taking place in rural America, as opposed to, you know, what we typically see in movies and documentaries and books about the culture wars, which is things that are taking place in urban America in the late 60s and early 70s and on college campuses. And what's so fascinating is that here in this case, all of the people who were pitted against one another, they knew each other and they lived in this same small community. And I think that's what's compelling about his story is there were a bunch of different historical actors in this one small community, even in an institution, no less, a junior high school of all things, who were essentially, I think, inhabitants of two different Americas. You know, one was a sort of a diversifying, you know, more sort of liberal America, for lack of a better term. And another one was a more rural sort of conservative America that was uncomfortable with a lot of the changes that were taking place in the wider nation. And so a lot of that, I conclude the book by saying that a lot of the ongoing culture wars that we see today, I think, are really first visible in cases like Wayne's from 1975.
And so the people of Hereford, Texas in the 1970s were not only feeling uncomfortable about the changes, but really within their own community, they were feeling uncomfortable and threatened by changes in their community as well.
That's right. And I, you know, when I set out to write this book, you know, one of the things that I wanted to do was to really humanize his antagonists. It would be all too easy to write a book that, you know, paints a young, naive English teacher as the victim of a bunch of people who are out to get him. And, you know, certainly the U.S. District Court in Amarillo did wind up finding that the school administration and the school board had violated Mr. Woodward's constitutional rights. But what fascinated me about his case was how a group of, you know, small town, otherwise good, family-oriented people could do this and do it sort of blindly, right? So what the book does is it places the courtroom drama and the case in the 1970s within a larger historical context. And, you know, I'd like to think that the book has accomplished that goal in really humanizing these people. And in an odd way, I think I've written a book that's somewhat sympathetic to the people who trampled on a young man's constitutional rights, and that it, you know, it sets out to really understand why things happened and why a young guy founding a chapter of the ACLU in a farming and ranching community could be interpreted as such a threat.
When I think of the ACLU and periods of times when it was demonized, I really think about the late 80s and early 90s when that particular culture war was brewing. You know, presidential candidates are using, he's a card-carrying member of the ACLU, as an epithet. Uh-huh. Now, certainly, I have no illusions that the ACLU was admired in the 1970s, but it certainly wasn't demonized the way it would be like maybe a half a generation or a generation later. What was it about the ACLU that so inspired fear from this small town, Hereford, Texas? I should mention it's out on the Texas Panhandle. It's the last little town you go before you head to southeastern New Mexico, fairly close to the border. So, So what was it about the ACLU that inspired this reaction?
You know, I think there's certainly a sense over time since the ACLU's founding of it being a, you know, a left-leaning organization that threatens certain conservative values. The organization was certainly founded in left-leaning politics during the, what we refer to as the progressive era in American history, which a lot of political historians would say is the time period in which we start to see the sort of the origins of the modern sort of welfare state that predated the New Deal, right? This idea that one can use the passage of laws to reform society and make it work better for regular people. The ACLU certainly stood up for certain cases that more conservative people would find unpopular. I mentioned in the book, so the first, about the first chapter and a half of the book is a sort of a longer kind of political history of Texas and the conservative Democratic Party sort of changing and shifting over time and the rise of the conservative Republican Party by the 60s and 70s. And there were certain instances where the ACLU was involved with things that, you know, a lot of people in rural America would have considered a threat, you know, whether it was support for the teaching of evolution in the 1920s with the famous Scopes monkey trial. I actually don't think that is in the book, but one story that is in the book was the support for the pecan sheller strike of San Antonio in 1938, which was spearheaded by a couple of young communist organizers, a young woman named Emma Tenayuca, most prominently. And so I do think there is a kind of a long durée memory in the 20th century of the ACLU being, you know, a leftist or left-leaning organization among many people who are more conservative in their politics. One of the things that I attempt to do in the book, though, is to try to understand the reaction against the ACLU's presence at the local level in Hereford in the 1970s in particular. And one of the interesting things that I explore in the book is the co-founder of the Hereford chapter of the ACLU with Wayne Woodward, which was a local Catholic priest by the name of Father Jose Gilligan. Now, in Hereford, there was a large Mexican and Mexican-American migrant labor community that lived in and around the labor camp called the San Jose Labor Camp, which had terrible living conditions in the 1970s. And so, you know, if we place the founding of this union within the context of the rural agricultural Southwest in the middle of the 1970s and a Catholic priest being involved in a majority minority community, then the arrival of the Union, one individual in particular suggested to me, augured the arrival of labor organizing and unionism in Hereford in particular, which was something that, you know, was a material threat. A lot of people who were involved with Hereford agribusiness would have said if migrant workers in the town went out on strike, which by 1975 they had been doing in the West and the Southwest for 10 years since the founding of the National Farm Workers Association by Cesar Chavez in California in 1965, which had reached into Texas, by the way, by the mid-60s and still had a presence in the 70s. If the ACLU then arrived, then what that could do is upend the town's economy. Not to mention, you know, some of the hallmarks of the, you know, the civil rights movement, which were school walkouts, students' rights cases, which the ACLU was then known to take up. And so I think then, you know, in that sense, it makes sense that the ACLU would be interpreted as such a threat, not necessarily that it would be such a threat. And I think, you know, I think that that in part explains why this young idealistic teacher who didn't even really self-identify as a hippie or a liberal or a troublemaker, but, you know, was definitely out of step with the town's larger political culture. I think that helps to explain why he was able to work in a small town, a conservative small town like Hereford, for 6 years without really getting into trouble before. You know, I mean, there's some shenanigans and stuff that he got into at school and, you know, some sarcastic, you know, kind of exchanges with his principal and assistant or vice principal, excuse me, over political issues in the early 1970s. But things really didn't get serious until he was associated locally with the ACLU. And then, of course, boy, did they get serious fast.
Well, also early in the book, you also discuss what you call panhandle conservatism. In many ways, it sort of foreshadows the more contemporary conservatives movement that we would come to know, say, in the 1990s, in the 2000s. And in many ways, it sort of foreshadows movement conservatism today, or maybe not today, but within the last 10 years.
Yeah, I think so. Certainly, I mean, and there, you know, there are certain traits that are involved with, you know, the politicization of a conservative culture in the by the 1970s that are deeply admirable. You know, a sense of civic duty, a sense of self-reliance. You know, sort of going it kind of your own way. In the book, we explore issues related to a sort of a frontier kind of Western identity, right? That, you know, people who live in rural communities are strong and self-reliant and don't require any sort of assistance or direction from federal officials, or even in the case for a lot of Texas conservatives, from people in Austin. And that sort of sense of rugged individualism that some historians of the conservative movement have referred to as cowboy conservatism, right? Like, you know, the sort of the cowboy image of Ronald Reagan as he was rising to the fore in the 70s and then in the 80s. This has been studied by historians like Jeff Roche from the College of Wooster in Ohio, Sean Cunningham from Texas Tech, which is near here, who really appropriate that identity because they know that, you know, people who were opposed to certain developments with the Democratic Party, you know, which I explore in the book, the arrival of a sort of a big government kind of liberalism in the 1930s, which shocked a lot of small government people and, you know, people who saw the expansion of state power as a threat. And then also, you know, those who interpreted certain things that were related to, you know, FDR's New Deal as being condescending or being judgmental to a way of life that people really cherished. These were very real problems that people faced. And I think that you're right, Rich. I think that the sort of notion of being a strong, independent, kind of, you know, frontier-minded sort of Western person, it does get appropriated by figures who, you know, aren't necessarily a part of that tradition, right? I mean, yeah. Ronald Reagan, you know, came to fame in California. George W. Bush, obviously, and had a sort of a closer tie to, I think, you know, the West and Texas, but former President Trump, certainly, I mean, from New York. I mean, he, I think in certain respects, stylizes himself the same way, even though he's not from that tradition. And there's a reason why a lot of Americans find that sort of political aesthetic appealing, I think.
Well, also, as I was reading that section of the book where you're sort of examining the roots and the fact that, you know, in the 50s and 60s, it's a fertile ground for the John Birch Society, which perhaps meant something different in that particular part of the world than, say, more urban settings on the East Coast or the West Coast. But nonetheless, I just kept thinking about, you know, Hereford, Texas was ground zero in the Dust Bowl. And the people that's, that made it through the Dust Bowl are these survivors. Now, probably they existed on a lot of government help during that time. But nonetheless, there's this sort of feeling that probably when you look at the population of Hereford, it contracted, like all of the panhandle, it contracted greatly during the 1930s and 40s and probably didn't recover for decades. And that sort of survivor mentality probably goes into this ethos as well.
Yeah, that's exactly right. There's a really great book that's about 15 or 16 years old by now. It was written by a New York Times columnist named Timothy Egan. It's called The Worst Hard Time on the Dust Bowl, which is a bestseller and is a book that I often have students in my Texas history or Western history classes read. And in that book, Egan really gets into the history of small towns in the Panhandle. And one really interesting example is the town of Dalhard, which is sort of north of Hereford, you know, even closer to the New Mexico state line. And in Dalhart, there was a man who later became a famous sort of regional newspaper man and booster by the name of John McCarty, who was so incensed that the federal government under the Resettlement Administration and the New Deal was essentially paying people to leave that he started an organization called the Last Man's Club, where the members of the Last Man's Club in Dalhart committed themselves to being the last people to leave during the times of the Dust Bowl. And it's really quite interesting, you know, and I think that there's certainly that in that interpretation. It's interesting in the book, FDR did really, really well in the 1930s here in the Texas Panhandle for obvious reasons, you know. The federal government did a lot to keep food on the table, to bring electricity to rural areas where it didn't exist before. But there's a later sort of a backlash politics, that develops against some of the perception of condescending attitudes or government control, or perhaps we can say maybe more accurately, government sort of overstaying its welcome, right? That it had a role, but then it stuck around for too long and seemed to be condescending to people. And I didn't grow up in a rural sort of setting, but I, you know, in writing this book, I understand why people reacted the way that they did. You know, there was a famous film in 1936 called The Plow That Broke the Plains, which was done by a filmmaker named Per Lorentz, who was on the government payroll under the auspices of the Works Progress Administration. And the film chronicled problems related to agriculture prior to the Dust Bowl, you know, this sort of intensive cash crop, sometimes offsite ownership of farms where, farmers would sort of try to get in and get as much out of their wheat crop on the market as they could in the 19-teens and 1920s, and that this created issues with, you know, the topsoil and, you know, the sort of the drier climate here on the plains that, you know, later came back to really haunt the region by the middle of the 1930s. And, you know, Lorentz wasn't wrong, right? And I think a lot of farmers at the time would have recognized that. But, you know, the answer in the film, of course, is government assistance to proper farming practices and, you know, a sort of a more sustainable kind of focus. And I think a lot of people who were alive at the time and who, like you aptly said, survived the Great Depression really took issue with that. And I, you know, one of the other things, this is a bit of a side note that I wanted to highlight. You mentioned sort of a population drain from the Southern Plains, which of course is absolutely right and well known. And, you know, there's a case to be made for a sort of a conservative plain folks politics that traveled with people who left the Southern Plains out into places like California or other parts of the Sun Belt. So this is really, you know, what we're talking about is really this, this sort of genesis of this kind of modern conservative culture that coalesces and comes together eventually at the ballot box by, you know, in particular the 60s, but certainly by the 70s, and then absolutely by 1980 with the election of Ronald Reagan.
My guest today is Timothy Paul Bowman, who's an associate professor of history and chair of the Department of History at West Texas A&M University. He's the author of You Will Never Be One of Us, A Teacher, A Texas Town, and the Rural Roots of Radical Conservatism. It's published by the University of Oklahoma Press, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, let's talk a little bit about Wayne Woodward. Wayne Woodward was a teacher at the junior high. He was part of a, you know, I remember when I was in school, and I was in school during this time, and, you know, there was sort of this divide between younger teachers and older teachers, and I think I really see him as sort of caught up in that. You know, younger teachers were sort of questioning the way things were done in education, and I think Wayne is an excellent example of that. He was idealistic. He was trying to expose his classroom to new ways of thinking about history and literature, and that sort of ran a little bit afoul, but it was really this whole idea of founding the ACLU with a couple other teachers and other people in the community that really sort of inflamed the power structure, the white power structure of Hereford.
Yeah, I think that's right. And, you know, it's interesting that you point out the generation gap. I, you know, having been an educator for more than a decade now. Yeah. I mean, you know, I think there is a tendency to see new young faculty members as sort of different, right? They may have different approaches or different ways of doing things. But, you know, what you've mentioned is, to me, the real tragedy of Wayne's story. You know, as a fellow educator, here is someone who clearly had the gift for being in the classroom and breaking through to his students. The book opens with a poem that a young middle school kid wrote to Wayne in the spring of 1975 when she found out that he wasn't going to be coming back. And she likens his departure from the school as like a death, that it really hurt her that much. And in interviewing Wayne and interviewing some of his former students and just having casual conversations with some of his former students, they all remembered him fondly. He had a sort of a, you know, a relatability that gifted teachers often do, that students felt free to speak their minds in his classroom, whatever their backgrounds may have been, that they wanted to be in there with him and learning. And I think that some of what drove this were those, you know, those sorts of differences, which were, I think, on a lot of people's minds in the 1970s, you know. They saw Wayne as a product of the 60s and the things that were changing in the country that they may or may not have been comfortable with. And they feared that he, you know, that he would break through to some of their kids and these young students and really change them in ways that they disagreed with. So the generational differences there were really quite profound.
He was fired. Another teacher that was also in the ACLU immediately recanted his membership and was allowed to stay. And so really it came down, as it would come down in federal district court, to he was essentially fired for founding this local chapter of the ACLU, which is blatantly unconstitutional, even in West Texas. But he never, you know, he won the case, but the school district intended to appeal, and he would never set foot in a classroom again, even though he won his case.
That's the real tragedy. You know, I, as a historian, there is nothing more important, and I really mean this, there's nothing more important to me personally than being in the classroom with my students. I mean, that's what keeps me going every day. That's what inspires me to write and to do research. And, you know, I mean, you can have a classroom that for whatever reason is a real slog, but if you're able to break through to just one student, even, it really changes things for you. And so that's the real tragedy. It's interesting that you mentioned the other teacher. This was a history teacher named Bruce Logan, who was close friends with Wayne, who, you're right, he resigned. And I think it's a deposition in the book that I cite where he says, you know, I basically did this out of a sense of protecting my bread and butter, you know, making sure that he could still have a career. He resigned and he fled to San Antonio, which he believed was going to be a much more sort of welcoming environment to a young teacher who was like him, who was a bit more idealistic and, again, you know, for lack of a better term, more liberal. And whereas Wayne wound up never teaching again, he applied for hundreds of teaching jobs while the case was ongoing. It was fired in 1975. The appeals process wasn't settled until the spring of 1977. But his colleague, Bruce Logan, went on to have this isn't in the book, mind you, but went on to have a long career in San Antonio that was quite successful as a history teacher and a debate coach. So his impulse, Logan's impulse, I think, was correct. He was able to keep going with his career, whereas Wayne, unfortunately for him, had to switch tracks.
Can you contrast what happened to Woodward then with the efforts that are happening today and pushing back and attacking teachers and increasingly school librarians that offer new perspectives on history, on race, on gender, on sexuality? Are there parallels? Was this an early shot in the culture wars on education that would erupt later?
I think it was a shot in the culture wars on education. I think these problems are older. You know, the Scopes monkey trial of the 1920s, where a biology teacher broke state law by teaching the theory of evolution in order to test the constitutional viability of that law, is certainly a part of the longer history here of teachers either pushing against the powers that be and challenging unfair rules, or of others attempting to silence or exert teachers out of a sense of wanting to control what happens in the schools. And so certainly I don't think that any of the problems that we're seeing with regard to the censorship of books or attempting to get teachers to not say certain words or teach certain concepts in the classroom, none of this stuff that's going on today is new to me, at least. I mean, I think there are times when these problems are, you know, potentially more prominent, and those times can be, probably correlated with moments of great social or political division in the country. You know, I mean, certainly what it meant to be a liberal and what it meant to be a conservative in the 60s and 70s were being redefined. And I think in a similar way, you know, the sort of the ideological stability of what it meant to be a conservative or what it meant to be a liberal since, let's say, the 70s or 80s, those are also undergoing redefinition now, you know, I mean, especially since the election of Trump in 2016 and the ongoing sort of political divisions that we're seeing in the country today.
Timothy Bowman, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks very much, Rich. I appreciate it.
Timothy Paul Bowman is an associate professor of history at West Texas A&M University, where he chairs the history department. He's the author of You Will Never Be One of Us, A Teacher, A Texas Town, and The Rural Roots of Radical Conservatism. It's published by the University of Oklahoma Press. I spoke with him back in October of 2022. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.